Just to start off with, I'd like to acknowledge the large number of people that are working on this project or on related projects, some of whom are at this meeting. Jean-Pierre Devilliers, who is not at this meeting, who's now at Calgary, worked with me to develop the code I'll be talking about today. Steve Balbus, who is not here but will be at this program later. Julian Krolik, who is here, Shigenobu Hirose, and Charles Gammy. Charles is also here, obviously. And here's the list of references which are relevant to this talk. Okay, here are some of the accretion questions which have been posed at this talk, or at this meeting. These are the usual set of things. Some of these questions have people have given answers to, but I'd like to say today, today in this talk, all these questions will be answered. I would like to say that, but in fact, it would not be true. We do have some ideas, partial answers for some of these things. Okay. Just to sort of introduce the topic, we're doing direct numerical simulations of a specific model problem. In this particular case, it's gas accretion, MHD gas accretion into a black hole with a static space-time of a Kerr black hole. We would like to aim for a long-term evolutions where we've run the simulation for a long enough time so that we would be moving to something like a quasi-steady state that you could then analyze to get insights into some of the questions that we just saw there. One aspect of the work that I'm going to be talking about is the question of large-scale magnetic field. I think everybody is in agreement that a large-scale strong magnetic field would be very useful in the central engine. The question is, how do you get that? We've seen a lot of simulations, and there's a long history of simulations that start with a large-scale vertical field imposed on the problem, either with a disk that's dynamically evolved or the disk as a boundary condition. And I think the history of those simulations shows very clearly that if you have such a field, the problem of jet formation and jet acceleration is much easier to deal with. That is to say, they have demonstrated that large-scale magnetic fields can produce jets. So the question is, how do we get to that stage? We would like to have our numerical evolutions be largely independent of the boundary conditions that are imposed and independent of the initial conditions. Again, this is in the ideal case. We're perhaps not entirely there yet. And finally, in this sort of thing, we would like to see the evolution of the accretion disk from a fully self-consistent picture. That is to say, we're trying not to have any sort of parameters that we have to stick in, but are actually seeing what the ideal MHD equations would give us. Now, the reason this tends to be sort of difficult is that at the very minimum, we think that accretion flows are magnetohydrodynamic, that is the stress within the accretion disk, comes from MHD, and that three-dimensional simulations, that is three space dimensions, are essential because you do have a case where you both have a turbulence and effectively a magnetic dynamo operating. And the properties of turbulence and the existence of dynamos depends on three spatial dimensions. Unfortunately, that makes the problem a little more difficult to do. We expect that the disks are going to be dynamically unstable locally. That's what leads to the turbulence. And there may very well be sort of global dynamical instabilities as well, which are, of course, interest. But again, that points to the need for time-dependent simulations. Okay, a little brief history of the sorts of simulations that have been done. Starting 14 years ago, with a local shearing box picture, first in 2D and then 3D, where one just goes to a frame, a co-rotating frame, where one ignores the geometry, spherical geometry, but includes Coriolis forces and tidal forces, and this is what has led us to gain understanding of the magnetorotational instability in a variety of physical situations, and including a variety of different sorts of physics. And work in the shorter shearing box limit continues today. And in fact, Julian Krolik will be talking later this afternoon about the first, or well, not quite the first, but results involving radiation transport in the shearing box limit, so adding more physics. And then as time has gone by, we've various people, including my group, has been trying to add additional physics. And finally, the latest is full global simulations in the Kerr metric, which is what we're going to talk about today. Okay. Now, the topic of general relativistic MHD codes, of course, we all say, well, it's an exciting new topic, but I'd like to point out that the first GR MHD simulations were published in 1975 by Jim Wilson, who ran a 20 by 30 grid in axis symmetry, including a full MHD simulation around a Kerr hole. We might regard 20 by 30 grid zones today as rather small, and I think this is just an example of the fact that Jim Wilson was so far ahead of his time that it took 30 years for the computers to catch up with his vision, which is, I'm sure, a bit of a shame, but at least the fact that Wilson did this back in 1975 means that there's no point in any of us arguing about who did what first, because Wilson did it all first. Okay, some of the contemporary people who are working on simulations include Kouidi et al., which was discussed briefly in a number of previous talks. Of course, Komissarov has already given a talk showing some results from his work. Charles, as one of the organizers of this workshop, has graciously recused himself from giving a presentation, although I believe collaborators of Charles have a poster in the back and some other stuff about the simulations they've done. De Villiers and Hawley, of course, what I'm talking about today. And this is Stu Shapiro's group, who are also working in collaboration with Charles at Illinois. So there's a lot of work in GRMHD going on. And in that spirit, I created a logo for the people associated with Charles Gammy and his extended research group. So when the question time comes for this particular talk, be sure to ask Charles questions as well, since he's working on these problems too. The particular code that I'm using, the De Villiers and Hawley code, we use a fixed Kerr metric using spherical Boyer-Lindquist coordinates. This is actually in keeping with the great Wilson tradition. So Jim Wilson used Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, and damn it, that's good enough for him. It's good enough for me. Although other people will tell you the virtues of Kerr-Schild coordinates. We use graded radial mesh so that we concentrate grid zones down near the horizon. Because we're using Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, we can't take the inner boundary of the problem all the way down to the horizon, but we get close to the horizon. We concentrate our theta zones at the equator, because when this project started, I was mainly concerned with the properties of the accretion disk itself. But when jets popped up, then suddenly one became interested in that, and it happened that the grid zones were concentrated down at the equator, so the jets weren't as well resolved as one might have hoped. The induction equation is done in this form, which is, for the aficionados of this field, is the constrained transport form, which conserves div b equals zero. Our equations that we use are baryon conservation, stress energy conservation, and entropy conservation. That is, we use an internal energy formulation and no cooling. This is a different approach from the approach taken by many of the other people working on GRMHD. And of course, the advantage of that is that at this time we're not sure what the optimal algorithms are for different situations, and it would be nice to have direct head-to-head simulations, direct comparisons between different codes. Okay, so overall, this code is similar to the highly successful, at least in terms of numbers of trees felled for producing papers, to the highly successful Zeus Code, which was developed by Stone and Norman and friends over many years ago. Now, the simulations that I'm going to talk about today have been a series of simulations starting from this particular initial condition, which is an isolated torus of gas, which is located in orbit around a black hole with a pressure maximum at 25 m. The torus has a weak magnetic field inside it, which is a poloidal field, which lies along the equipotential surfaces inside the torus. The idea here, again, is to try to have a reservoir of gas from which an accretion disk can form, so that you're not trying to feed the disk from outside by pumping gas in some manner, and having a torus which has completely self-contained initially, a completely self-contained magnetic field, with the idea that if any sort of large-scale field configuration develops, then it would do so naturally, rather than being imposed from the start. We place the outer boundary out just beyond 100 m in radius. Grid resolution that is used for these simulations is 192 radial zones, 64 phi zones over the quarter plane. So we're just doing one quarter of the full 2 pi plane, and 192 theta zones running from the close to the zero axis down to close to the pi axis at the bottom, so there's no equatorial symmetry assumed. We've done an ensemble of black hole spins, including the Schwarzschild case, up to some fairly substantial spins, and one case with a counter-rotating hole, which is actually one of the more interesting cases. You know, whether or not it's astrophysically realistic or not, you can certainly discuss, but it's very interesting from the point of view of contrasting with the positive spin cases in the Schwarzschild case. Now, the sort of generic outcome of these simulations is given in this sort of schematic diagram here. Starting with a torus, which was initially located out here, an accretion disk forms, which is basically sort of a constant opening angle wedge, which is turbulent, has lots of variations internally with time and space, but is slowly accreting down to something we call the inner torus, which is simply a point where the accretion disk reaches a local pressure maximum prior to the flow through the so-called plunging region into the black hole. Surrounding the disk is a coronal region, which has a nearly sort of equipartition magnetic field, low density stuff flowing outwards but is bound, and then an evacuated funnel along the spin axis. Surrounding the funnel is something we call a funnel wall jet, which is a narrow column of material going out at high enough velocities as to be unbound. And interior to that point is a pointing flux jet. That is, the funnel has magnetic field in it and is driving a pointing flux out. Okay, so that's supposed to be moving. Whoops. That's bearing. There we go. Okay. So this is a view of late time in a particular evolution of density. So you're seeing the disk here. These simulations will run out to 10,000 m in time, which is a number of orbits at the initial pressure maximum, lots and lots of orbits down near the black hole. This is the A equals 0.9 simulation, and what's visualized there is simply a gas density in a linear scale, a 3D volumetric rendering. It's simply to show basically the disk structure. And the fact that you can see, sort of spiral waves moving out, which have been sort of generated by the turbulence, and the buildup of density down near the black hole itself. In the next sequence, we zoom in again for these last 2,000 m of time, And you can see the inner torus here of the disk, and what you'll see over this particular period of time is sort of the inner torus building up and then accreting into the black hole. So there can be fairly substantial changes in disk structure over, you know, a few orbits of time. So there goes the inner torus has changed. In large consequence, the accretion rate varies a lot with time, and it varies with fairly high frequency down near the here in the plunging region. But there's no reason why the at any given moment why the accretion rate at any particular radius should match up with the accretion radius at any other, or the accretion rate at any other radius. And so the whole thing tends to be fairly unsteady. The initial torus, this is out to 20 m here, and the initial torus's inner boundary came to 15 m. So the pressure maximum of the initial torus was outside that region. Okay. So this is sort of in a quasi-steady state at this time, which we gauge by a number of measures, including the fact that the sort of the time average accretion rate over this period of time is constant with radius, and the mass in the torus here, integrated from sort of 20 m on in, is roughly constant over this period of time. So mass is flowing through the torus, mass is flowing through the disk, but the disk itself is neither building up nor dying down. Over the course of the simulation, about between 10 and 15% of the total initial torus mass ends up having moved through the disk into the black hole. Okay. Within the disk, we have turbulence, and we have active MRI, magnetorotational instability, creating stresses. And here's a visualization just of some field lines that are inside the torus down. This is a spinning hole case, so it's down close to the location of the marginally stable orbit. The field is tangled. The toroidal field always dominates naturally because of the shear in the disk. The field inside the disk is always sub-equal partition. Typical values maybe beta 10, that is magnetic gas pressure to magnetic pressure 10:1. Field is of course highly correlated and produces the stress which drives the accretion. As with the local simulations, the stress that's produced by the magnetic field is sort of the alpha value, if you will, is sort of half the magnetic pressure. Okay, so if you want to parameterize stress, it's better to use beta than alpha. Okay, so we're making progress. We've moved up one letter in the Greek alphabet. Okay. Now, here's the point that's been discussed somewhat already today, is this issue about stress continuing inside the marginally stable orbit, and it does in these simulations. Here is a plot of the normalized fluid frame magnetic stresses in a 0.9 Kerr hole simulation, plotted against the Novikov stress model, which has to drop to zero at the location of the marginally stable orbit. And one can see that, you know, sort of out here in this region where the stress is basically determined by the condition that the disk be in Keplerian rotation, you know, it's fine, it does that, but it doesn't turn over. It just keeps going on in, and this is because the field continues to connect the fluid elements within the disk through the plunging region and down to the black hole. So that in fact, it enables the black hole to exchange angular momentum with the disk itself. Normalized. I don't think it's not.
In order to cross compare the simulations of different spins, the normalized quantities of units of stress could be initial pressure at the pressure map.
Yeah, I was going to say. So the
Novikov Thorne model is at the appropriate unit at the accretion rate at that moment.
So do the numbers on the y-axis have any significance that the audience can understand? No. Yeah, they go like this. Yeah, no, that's not significant. That is not significant. There is no stress in a hydro disk. What are you talking about? I mean, you can make up anything you want, but. Well, I think we can all agree with the concept that to the extent that the viscous stresses can be represented by an alpha disk, then there would be similarities between the alpha model and... yes, but actually when you get down into this region, it's less sort of a local viscous stress sort of picture and more a significant non-local torque picture of the kind that is discussed in GAMI 99, yeah, which has no turbulence at all, but is simply the connection using a poloidal field, a connection between the spinning black hole and the disk. Okay. Another aspect is that the magnetic field exerts stress at higher latitudes compared to the usual location of the disk. In these plots, the dashed lines show the basically where the Reynolds stress is significant within the disk, and the solid lines show the locations of the Maxwell stress or the magnetic stress. In particular, as you go to higher and higher spins, the stress becomes fairly constant. The magnetic stress becomes fairly constant and continues out to high latitudes. That is supposed to be theta here. I keep forgetting that I need to fix this. It's for some reason it did not export the Greek symbol to the postscript. Not that you care, but I just want to show that I am aware of the limitations, and I know what the problem is. I just haven't fixed it. Okay. Now, another thing that was discussed extensively today and on other days was the question of the iron K alpha lines. In particular, the idea as to whether those lines sort of terminate at the location of the marginally stable orbit. And the reason for thinking that is that if you look at the surface density in the traditional Novikov-Thorne model, the surface density in the disk drops off very rapidly near the marginally stable orbit. And here we plot surface density in arbitrary units versus ratio of R to RMS. So that places the marginally stable orbit here at 1 for all the different spin models. What we find in these cases, in fact, the surface density does drop off, but it doesn't do so quite as rapidly as in the Novikov-Thorne model. And so this brings up the question which was discussed in Kolick and Holly, what year was it? 99 or 2000 something? The question of the actual location of the reflection edge in an accretion disk, which would be the point where the optical depth is such as to give you the last location for iron line fluorescence. And it's not clear. I believe our conclusion was that the actual location need not be at the marginally stable orbit, but could be exterior to the marginally stable orbit or interior to the marginally stable orbit. And I feel fairly confident that that result will hold up under further analysis. Okay. Yes.
Yes.
The material is not in free fall. Okay, it is accelerating, but it's not really plunging in the sort of regular picture. But the thickness of these disks is sort of on order, basically 0.1 to 0.15 h over r, which is thicker than the traditional, well, I don't know what's traditional. It's thicker than lots of disks. That's another safe statement.
Lots of disk models.
Lots of disk models, yes. And of course, I mean, people say, such as our previous speaker, say, why don't you guys do a nice thin disk? And the reason, of course, is that it's a question of resolution, computer time, and related difficulties, which simply make it easier in a slightly thickened disk to have the time scales and the dynamical scales more comparable. Okay, it's not that we're just being pigheaded and want to do thicker disks. Okay, so there does remain the question of what happens as the disk is cooler and thinner. Okay, to summarize then, some of the general properties of accretion disks that we see from the simulations. One of the main results, which is consistent both with the GR simulations and the Newtonian simulations and the local simulations, everything, is that the angular momentum distribution in accretion disks always wants to be of a Keplerian power law. Now, again, in these disks, the disk is somewhat thickened, and so there is a pressure, and so everywhere the actual value of the angular momentum tends to be slightly sub-Kepler, but the power law is omega going like r to the minus 3/2. Our models have been run for several thousand m in time, which is long enough to come into an approximate steady state. The angular momentum transport is mainly within the disk through MHD turbulence due to the magnetorotational instability. There's nothing that shows up particularly about the marginally stable orbit. There are large-scale fluctuations in the flow, and one tends to see low M spiral features in the flow. No stress edge, and we have evidence for angular momentum transport from the black hole to rotating black hole to the disk itself. And we see relative accretion rates dropping as a function of increasing black hole spin. Again, in part because of the spinning black hole interfering with the inflow. Okay, this is just a quick animation to show the process by which the disk produces a corona of gas surrounding the thick accretion disk. This is in a logarithmic plot of density. So the thing that we're calling the disk is the sort of the red region, but this backflow surrounding it is basically a pressure and magnetic pressure driven outflow, which surrounds the disk, leaving sort of the evacuated funnel region here. Okay, so the corona forms quite naturally. We find that on average the magnetic fields within the corona is kind of on average about beta of 1, although it varies from regions which are magnetically dominant, beta of 0.1, and in regions where there's the magnetic field is not quite so strong, beta of 10. The corona that is produced by these simulations, the corona is bound, although it's less bound than the initial torus. And since the torus starts out fairly close to the black hole, the torus gas starts out fairly bound. In the corona, instead of turbulence, you have complicated large-scale motions. No, it was also bound, but less bound than the initial torus. Okay, turning now to jets. I put it to you that jets are a combination, are produced by rotation, accretion, and magnetic field. I realize this is highly controversial, particularly for this audience. Nevertheless, I think all the work that's been done by various people for the last couple of decades clearly points to that. Now, we end up with a funnel which looks something like this. For those of you familiar with the American boxing scene, this, of course, would be the Don King model of jet production. This is a rotating black hole. Radial field forms in the funnel extending out and is spun up by the rotation of the black hole, which is producing an outward going pointing flux. It's carrying energy and angular momentum out away from the black hole. Along the funnel wall, sort of where you see this green area, there is a thin region of gas which is also moving out at an unbound velocity. And we call that the mass outflow is at the funnel wall, we call the funnel wall jet. That's the only place where there's a significant mass outflow. Here's just some visualizations of the magnetic field for an ensemble of black hole spins. Here's the field going into a Schwarzschild hole, and you can see clearly that as you go up to higher spins, the magnetic field is being wrapped around by the black hole, simply due to the GT phi term in the metric. All right, now this is a movie of pointing flux. That is what's being what is being visualized here is TRT of the electromagnetic tensor. So and it basically starts initially with the torus and then the accretion, and then you saw relatively quickly after the first matter moves down into the black hole, magnetic field is ejected into the funnel. And this magnetic field amplification and ejection process is basically quite similar physically to what we've seen described already in terms of the formation of magnetic towers, as has been described. As you have a radial field which is undergoing considerable differential rotation, toroidal field is being amplified. It doesn't see anything above it, so it just pops up and fills the empty funnel. Once it gets into the funnel, it basically stays there and is being torqued by the black hole down at the bottom and continues to drive an outgoing pointing flux through the length of the simulation. Very, very low density, scraping up against the numerical floor of the simulation. Yeah, but it's at the numerical floor.
So in that sense, density is
Yeah. Right. The mass density. Yes. It's all the energy in the funnel is pointing flux. If you look at this jet, you get some collimation here within the first say 20 m of radius, and then it's pretty much on a constant cone outside of that, out to 100 m, which is the boundary of this visualization. The total evolution time that you're seeing here is 10,000 m visualized with images which were produced every 5 m in time and shown to you at 30 frames a second. And that's the end of that. Copies are available on DVD. Okay. Basically, in this image, we look at the pointing flux for different black hole spin parameters from the Schwarzschild case, which is up here. Which one basically doesn't see much of anything. And then a slow increase as you go to A over M of 0.5 to 0.9 to 0.998. So the spinning black hole is definitely driving the pointing flux. Now in this table, we look at the dependence of the jet and its outflow with spin, black hole spin, which is the first column over here. Again, for simulations running from a Schwarzschild case up to close to one and one retrograde spin case. Now, the first column is eta jet, which is the efficiency in the sense of we're looking at the energy in the jet outgoing versus the basically m dot c squared into the black hole from the accretion. One sees with a Schwarzschild case, basically the jet is removing only a very tiny amount of energy compared to the usual Schwarzschild accretion energy. Okay, and as one goes up to higher spins, that number goes up. Now it's helpful to look at that number by comparing it to the efficiency associated with the marginally stable orbit, which is the next column. So in the case of, say, the Schwarzschild hole, where the traditional efficiency is given by the binding energy of the marginally stable orbit, which for a Schwarzschild hole is about 6%, then the energy in the jet compared to that value is only 3%. So it's not terribly large, but as you go up to a high spin, you get a larger number. Now, this one for the counter-rotating hole is slightly anomalous in the sense that because the marginally stable orbit for the counter-rotating hole is out at about 9m, the binding energy there is not very low at all. And so but the energy in the pointing flux jet is coming not from the accretion flow per se, but from the fact that the magnetic field is being driven by the spinning black hole. So the actual energy in the spinning black hole is powering the jet, and so the accretion energy here is not particularly important at all. So that number tends to be large. This last column is the ratio of the energy in the pointing flux compared to the energy that is in the unbound matter flow in the funnel wall jet, okay, minus the contribution in the funnel wall jet, which is simply mc squared. That is, remove the rest mass energy, use the rest of the energy, and compare that to the pointing flux jet. And what one finds is, again, in the Schwarzschild case, everything but 6% of the energy is in the matter going out in the funnel wall jet. But as one goes to higher spin, more and more of the energy is in the pointing flux, up to where you nearly have, in the maximum case, you have about as much energy in the pointing flux jet as you have in the funnel wall jet, in the matter component. So as you go to high spins, then the jet becomes more and more pointing flux dominated. Okay, so summary of funnels and jets. We get jet produced in the funnel, but the only place where there is any significant mass flow is in the funnel wall, and that's because, again, material with angular momentum is going to be excluded from the interior of the funnel. In the mass flux jet, the funnel wall jet, the outgoing velocities are sort of half the speed of light. The pointing flux jet is, of course, about at the speed of light. And the boost factors in the funnel are large, but they are at the limit which we can handle numerically. So I can't tell you how large they could get. Pointing flux dominates within the funnel. The jet luminosity increases with black hole spin. It's the black hole that's powering the pointing flux jet, not the accretion per se. And in fact, in the case of the counter-rotating black hole, if you look at the angular momentum being carried out by the pointing flux, it's the same sign of angular momentum as the hole and not the accretion flow. Whereas the angular momentum in the mass flux funnel wall jet in that case has the same sign as the accretion flow. Fraction of the jet luminosity and pointing flux, again, increases with spin. In the question of what's doing the acceleration of the jet, in particular the funnel wall jet, we've looked at Lorentz forces, and it looks like both pressure and Lorentz forces seem to be important, and we were never able to extract any specific indication of a preference for one or the other of the mechanisms that have been talked about in the past, including the fling and the spring. Okay. All right, so at the beginning of this talk, I suggested that maybe some answers to some of the questions might possibly be available. Here are a few of the answers that we have to date. What disk structures arise naturally? Near Keplerian disks. Always near Keplerian distribution of angular momentum. And it seems very natural to be surrounded by a magnetized corona, as the magnetic field bubbles out of this thing. What are the properties of the disk turbulence? Again, turbulence driven by the MRI. Large-scale fluctuations, low M spiral features, toroidal fields dominate. Is there a dynamo? Yes, there's a dynamo. in the sense that magnetic fields are amplified, they're maintained in the presence of dissipation, and we find a magnetic ejection, a magnetic tower ejection, fairly early on in this problem, which fills the funnel with basically a radial magnetic field that stays for the rest of the simulation. Are winds and jets produced? Yes, winds are produced. And they seem to be a natural outcome. Again, the simulations do not have cooling. Again, the funnel wall jet also seems to be a natural outcome of this particular type of simulation. Evacuated funnel with a magnetic field forming this so-called magnetic tower, and the pointing flux gaining most of its power from the black hole spin. The inner disk edge, it's time varying. Physical quantities vary smoothly. There's nothing, if you just look at the simulation, there's nothing that makes the marginally stable orbit per se stand out. And there's evidence for interaction between the spinning black hole and the disk. That is, angular momentum can be transferred from the black hole into the disk, affecting the accretion process, which is the last point here. Increasing efficiency with increasing black hole spin. Black hole spins adds to the jet power. And this is a point that Charles has emphasized in a paper, Gammy et al., or what was it, Shapiro et al.? Gammy et al., okay, good. If you look at the specific angular momentum that's going into the hole, it would tend to point towards a final spin value, which is more on the order of 0.9 rather than 0.998. So high spin holes in these cases would tend to be spun down. Less specific angular momentum is being carried in than would be needed to keep them that way. Okay, thank you.
Can you say something about jet collimation?
In my jets or in general?
No, in your simulation.
In my simulations, yes. The collimation that occurs is due to the high pressure gas close to the black hole in the torus and corona. And there's sort of a mild collimation down there, which gets you to a jet which has an opening angle of about between 20 and 30 degrees. And then once you're out beyond about 25 m or so, it basically moves out on a constant opening angle. So if there's going to be further collimation, one would expect it to take place at larger radius.
I was just wondering if you could comment or speculate on the character of the solutions for much thicker disks.
Much thicker disks.
Or thicker.
I like this guy. Thicker discs are easier to do. Well, what do you got in mind?
I don't know. The character of collimation, you just sort of emphasize the importance of the pressure forces.
Yeah.
Collimating would you speculate that they would be more highly collimated with a thicker disc?
You did a thicker disc, Charles. Pretty much, yeah. And we don't, because of the nature of the code, it's not total energy conserving, so we don't keep all of the energy, the thermal energy that would be in the disk. So if you started from a flow that started at large radius and it lost none of its heat, then H over R could be larger in the near hole region, and that could lead to better collimation. But
yeah, I think ours are.
Our outflows are slightly more collimated than yours. We have higher temperature disks, and we do have energy conservation, so that may explain that.
I was noticing that even in the pointing flux, as opposed to the density, there it's an evacuated region very near the axis. I'm trying to figure out why that is, and.
Yes,
a possibly related question is, since you have a boundary at some finite distance, I forget what it is the
radial boundary?
A radial boundary.
Yes.
So
120
for a field line that's co-rotating with the horizon, the light cylinder. Is the place where those field lines very near the axis intersect the light cylinder still within your boundary?
Let me answer that second question later, after I answer the first question, which is, why is there nothing on the axis? That's because there's a boundary condition on the axis. In order to avoid the singularity associated with the axis and the incredibly tiny time steps that would be associated with that, I have a reflecting cone. So that's why the axis is dark, although the magnetic field drops off to the axis anyway.
So let me sharpen my second question.
Okay.
At what angle to the axis does, at what, does the light cylinder just, does a ray at that angle meet the light cylinder before it leaves your region?
I don't know.
Okay.
Chris?
I wanted to ask about thinner disks,
okay,
whether you tried to simulate those or what your intuition is, in the sense that when you look at the galactic binaries, when they go into a state where they're completely dominated by what you'd interpret as a thin disk, the jet emission is strongly quenched.
Uh-huh.
So do you have any feeling for whether a small scale height disk would be able to launch a jet?
If you were able to get the magnetic field configuration, I can't see any reason why it wouldn't be able to launch a jet, unless things got so cold that there wasn't any surrounding corona to hold the field in place.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you see, that where there's no corona, there's a jet.
I haven't done any simulation where there wasn't a corona, so, but the corona does play a role in helping to keep the, there is a pressure associated with the jet, and it's in pressure balance in the theta direction, so if you didn't have anything there to hold the field in place, then...
John, what's your view toward trying a global field in the future as to explore whether nasty or non-thermal things happen?
Nasty non-thermal things?
Nastier. Different magnetic instabilities, a nastier jet, whatever.
I'm not sure what the adjective means in this context. maybe you mean gnarlier. Yeah, more energetic. Yeah, I think that the energy in the jet is going to be set by what the magnetic field strength is there. Other people have done simulations with net vertical fields and have gotten probably jets that are more energetic than that. Although some of those people are here, so they could tell you. We've done some vertical field simulations just to compare with what other people did, but not sort of as an independent thing. But the question comes back to, how do you form that field? Okay, how is that field going to be formed? Is it going to be brought in from the outside and just through the accretion flow, or is it going to be a process in the accretion flow by which some sort of stronger field than what I see could be formed? The field here on the axis has a value, a strength, which is set, is comparable sort of to the field strength that forms within the disk itself. So it's self-consistent in that sense. So I don't know how I could get a stronger field except, with speculative processes at this point, bringing in field from outside or something. But I don't think there's any question that if you have a stronger field, you can have stronger jets. That's been shown.
The magnetic field inside the polar region where you have the pointing flux jets appear to be unidirectional. Is it true?
The magnetic field when?
In the polar region where you have this force-free...
Right.
Is this a consequence of your initial conditions, or...?
The direction of the field is a consequence of the initial condition, yeah.
So...
We saw the same sort of process in somebody's simulation, several people's simulation the other day, which is a loop, basically a loop as the initial condition, and then it's dragged in and ejected so that you end up with field in one direction and the other direction. It's quite analogous to the magnetic tower formations that we saw in movies of Tuesday.
John, the properties of the jet that you get, do you actually, if you approach a steady state, do you go through any critical points? And more relevant to what I'm interested in, is there any interaction with this funnel wall flow? We had some scenarios about slow wind, fast wind. There are other scenarios that invoke it. So is there any such interaction that you can already see in your grid?
Is there any interaction that you can see?
Meaning that one runs into the other.
The funnel wall flow versus the pointing flux flow.
Yeah.
There is some evidence that the pointing flux flow is interacting with the funnel wall flow if you look at how the angular momentum of energy distributions are shifting as one goes out. So it does look like there's some energy going into the funnel
wall flow. But do you manage to get through the critical points so you are supersonic, super fast sonic?
I don't think there's any question about that within the funnel. Yeah.
Eric?
Just outside the funnel wall flow, I mean, it drops off rapidly to sort of a slow moving, so there's no well-defined surface out in the corona.
I just wanted to get the clarification. And when you said that the pointing flux part, when you spin the black hole up and you get the pointing flux dominating, and you, I think you said statements about the independence of the luminosity from the pointing flux compared to the accretion. And I wondered about the field strength on the whole. I would think that that would depend on the accretion rate, so that even the pointing flux that you're getting out, although the spin, of course, doesn't, but the field strength probably does depend on the accretion rate. Is that consistent with what you're saying?
Yeah, I think it's okay. Fair to say the strength of the field in the funnel is being set by the accretion. Yeah.
How much of the energy density confining the field close to the black hole could you attribute to the ram pressure of infalling material?
Not much. It's more thermal pressure, I think.
So it's mostly thermal pressure. You don't think that just having a dynamical situation amplifies the amount of field near the hole and the amount of energy you can extract from the spin? By much?
Yeah, I had nothing had leapt out at me to give me that impression, but that could just be my failure. But you know, it just seems to be thermal.
Greg,
you mentioned that you are sensitive somewhat to the initial condition for the magnetic field. It might be interesting to try initial conditions where you have parallel loops with opposite directions to see if that. So that there's no, you don't initialize any toroidal magnetic field, is that right?
That's right, yeah. I've done I didn't talk about it, but I have done simulations with an initial toroidal field.
Okay, so if there had been a toroidal field, then you would have some net helicity. And so if you put in a field with opposite signs, opposite twists, so that there was no net helicity, would that affect the final state? It would. I don't know.
I can tell you that if you put in a, do you have a response to this specifically?
Yeah.
He knows the answer.
He knows the answer, but it's all
he knows the answer, but
that's fine.
Yeah, I've done it. The only other field configuration I've done was a purely toroidal initial one, which does not produce a jet because you don't get this tower ejection. But Charles, you did something with multiple loops, didn't you? I keep putting you on the spot.
But.
John, could you say a little bit about the handling of dissipation in your code and so on, and perhaps just say what's on my mind is that if you had a sort of genuine local viscosity,
right,
there would be a sort of local dissipation associated with it, which would drop the energy where, you know, the degrad omega and so on. Alternatively, you could imagine the energy being transported away by, for example, large-scale hydromagnetic torques and deposited in a corona far, far away. And the answers could depend on physically on what happens, whereas in your code you have an inevitable amount of numerical viscosity which will deposit energy locally however hard you try. How important is this in practice?
Okay, should distinguish, when you say numerical viscosity, one should distinguish two kinds of numerical viscosity. One of which is an explicit numerical viscosity, which actually does increase the entropy. And the other would be a numerical dissipation, which does not increase the entropy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So when we, although we don't have any cooling, we do not in fact conserve all of the energy that is liberated. And so it's sort of like about 50% or thereabouts is lost. So it's not a completely non-cooling flow. Okay.
Okay.
I mean, that's a property of real radiating flow. They have this opportunity of losing energy.
Right.
Sorry. But
yeah.
But
so I modeled that in a completely uncontrolled way.
But I guess my question is, how much does this matter, even in the context of an adiabatic flow?
Right. Charles will answer that.
Okay. Actually, I got to use chairman's privilege to follow that. What did you do about the magnetic dissipation?
What did I do about the magnetic dissipation?
What?
I allowed it to happen.
So it's
there's no heating associated with loss of magnetic energy and grid reconnection.
So the
I have experimented with resistivity, both a physical sort of resistivity and an artificial sort of resistivity. And the amount of heating one gets typically is not very much. But it's at these sorts of resolutions, it has a worse effect on damping the turbulence than the amount of energy you manage to save out of the process.
Mm-hmm. When you say you have a dynamo going on, to what degree is that dependent upon the numerical resistivity or whatever passes for it?
Yeah. Well, the dynamo itself is really MRI dynamo.
Mm-hmm.
So the field amplification is, you know, doesn't care about the resistivity at all, but the thing that saturates the field certainly cares about the dissipation of the turbulence and reconnection at the grid scale. And the best place to look for answers there would be in the local shearing box simulations, where one can experiment with the resolution and the effects of resistivity.
Mm-hmm.
In these guys, there just aren't enough grid zones.
Okay, in your picture of your jet, you had, at least initially, you had the pointing flux jet in the center with the funnel wall jet surrounding it, right?
Right. Not initially. Shortly after.
Shortly afterwards, okay. Does that mean that in some sense, under certain conditions, we should expect the actual jets in nature to be hollow? In the sense of having the actual matter concentrated around an edge?
Would the jets be hollow? Unless you have a mechanism for completely removing the specific angular momentum from the matter that's accreting, you can't get into the funnel region. But if you had pair production or something going on, or it could fill in later.
I mean, okay, just a brief comment. I mean, that might have direct observational consequences.
Hollow jets might have direct, yes. Good. In that case, I predict hollow jets. That prediction belongs solely to me.
You mean
polyjets? Polyjets, yeah.